From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. First on today's podcast, what's the matter with Kansas?
The great state of Kansas passed away on March 31st, 2013.
The NASCARization of a once moderate state. Then the trial against Guatemalan dictator Efrain Rios Montt suffered a major setback, and Guatemalans and the international community are watching closely to see what happens next.
This trial is not just looking back at what happened 30 years ago. This trial is really a battle for the soul of Guatemala.
And on the other side of the world, Iranian political cartoonists are silenced by their government.
You have freedom of speech, let me tell you. You don't have freedom after speech.
Also, Carl Hyde of the electronic duo Underworld has a new solo album.
Did you sleep? I was sleeping, face pressed up against the window, body rocking to a southbound rhythm.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. The state that gave you White Castle, the Jayhawkers, Dorothy and Toto, now wants to give you something else, red state reform. We're talking about Kansas.
Let's show what lower taxes, more efficient use of government, more targeted government. Let's show a reformed pension system. Let's show these things to the country, and when they work, my belief is they will migrate nationally.
That's Kansas Governor Sam Brownback, and he wants to export what he calls the red state model. The plan is not without its opponents. One political writer says it's time to write the state's obituary, and he did.
The great state of Kansas passed away on March 31st, 2013, after a long and difficult battle with extremism.
And that's our cover story today, Red or Dead, the new Kansas experiment. When Jason Probst, almost 40, was a boy, Kansas was known for its centrist pragmatic politics. The saying was, when anything's going to happen in this country, it happens first in Kansas. The first woman ever elected to public office, early fights against slavery, Kansas was a bellwether politically. But Probst, a former machinist who now writes for the Hutchinson News, says the last election cycle killed that pragmatism off.
This legislative session has just been one thing after another that seemed like it was undoing a lot of things that had been done in the state over the last 100 years. A lot of progressive things.
A state once dotted with one-room schoolhouses gave rise to a series of inventors and creators. Then the whirlwind, outside political spending. In 2012, PAC spent almost $1 million in the last 10 days of primaries for the Republican state legislature. And there was more from third parties. Probst says it accelerated change, and that's not what he knows as conservative Kansas.
We like to move ahead with what we have and try to do the best work we can without shaking things up or moving too quickly or getting too radical about things.
Governor Sam Brownback, a former senator and a conservative Republican with presidential ambitions, took over as governor in 2010. Because of all that political spending, moderate Republicans lost, and Brownback now has the most conservative legislature in the state's history. The wind is at his back. But some Kansans, like Probst, see a pretty bleak future ahead. Let's go on with his litany.
Kansas has survived by widespread poverty, low-wage jobs, poorly educated children, out-migration, lobbyist-funded legislators, a maniacal hatred of government, and children who dream of living anywhere else.
For a small-town newspaper, Probst's obituary for Kansas went viral. Tens of thousands of people read it, and many are fellow Kansans who wrote to Probst to say they, too, are disturbed by their state's dramatic swing to the right.
A lot of emails that I received from people were people who said, I left the state to take care of an aging relative or to work, and I always plan to come back, but I'm not going to now.
Bob Beatty is a political scientist at Washburn University in Topeka. He remembers the moment when he noticed the money beginning to flow into Kansas politics. He was home watching TV. It was late October 2008. Barack Obama was running for president. And in Kansas's second district, a Democrat named Nancy Boida was defending her seat in the House of Representatives.
The Obama-Boida team. Higher taxes, more spending, wrong for Kansas.
Nancy Boida's face was superimposed over the familiar, circular Obama logo. You almost would have thought she was Obama's running mate, Beatty says.
Nancy Boida spent 2 years trying to do what she thought people wanted her to do. Not vote party line Democrat, but do what was best for her constituents for Kansas. She thought that that's how you get reelected.
But Boyda was defeated, and that race became a focal point for the influence of outside money. More than $1 million was spent on her race, and her opponent, a Republican, won by 4% and rode off to Washington that January.
In a sense, it became the sort of wild idea that it doesn't matter what she did. She was going to lose because she had a D next to her name.
D as in Democrat. And remember, we're talking pragmatic Kansas. Three of the last five governors have been Democrats. Kathleen Sebelius was elected governor twice before Obama called her up to the cabinet in 2009. In the years since, though, there's been even more outside money, and the conservative Republicans reign ascendant.
In many cases, they make the argument that a vote for a Democrat in Kansas, and even, and this is really interesting, even a vote for a moderate Republican in Kansas is essentially a vote for Barack Obama.
With the conservatives in full control of the Kansas legislature, Governor Brownback is leading the charge, and he says he wants Kansas to be on a glide path to zero income tax as a prescription for economic renewal. He's enacted the biggest tax cut in the state's history already, in this new Kansas that he calls the Red State Model. If Kansas leads, the governor says, the other 49 states will follow. We asked him to share more of that thinking.
The thinking is that this will create growth, and it already has. We are at zero on small business income. And so anybody listening to this show that's a person of small business, move to Kansas. No taxes. And that's already, we've had a record number of filings of LLCs in the state of Kansas with that move. And plus, we've taken our overall top income tax rate down to 4.9, and I want to take it to zero as a way of attracting investment, growth, and we're starting to see that happening. Most of this is anecdotal that we're getting now because that just went into effect first this year, but the LLC filings, that even happened last year.
But your own House of Representatives has given you some pushback on this. The thinking by even pro-business conservatives is that something is going to have to offset the loss in income tax, and sales tax might also be a turnoff to business.
Well, I mean, you've got to deal with it. Our state is heavily dependent upon the state income tax, but nearly 40% when I became governor. So you've got to work it down over time. You've got to become more efficient with your government. Our state number of state employees is down about 7%. You're going to have to get your resources somewhere to fund the central core functions of government, and you need to do them well. And what I'm suggesting is that state sales tax stay where it is rather than going down 0.6 cents, and that you use that sales tax to further ride the income tax rates down.
Governor Brownback, your state's fiscal calendar begins in July, and if Kansas keeps spending at the same rate, somewhere around $700 or $800 million are expected to be the shortfall. How do you plan to balance that?
Through a mixture of consolidation within agencies, of funding core functions well, but looking at a number of other state functions and saying, if we don't need to do this, let's not do it. So it's going to be on savings, better efficiency. Growth is critical. You got to have growth taking place, and that's what the tax cut was to stimulate. And then to maintain the sales tax at its current level, rather than having it go down 0.6%, as was scheduled to take place in the middle of this year.
But economists like Brad DeLong, a California academic looking at the Kansas model, says Brownback's tax cuts are a flawed plan.
That produces a relatively low-wage form of economic development that's attractive to those who own companies, but not so attractive to people who don't own companies.
He says Governor Brownback's plan is based on a formula that works in Texas and Florida, but Kansas has neither Texas's oil nor Florida's tourism. And even if it does work, Kansans might not like it when they start to see their basic services disappear. As for the red state model, the idea that Kansas will lead and the rest of the states will follow, DeLon says Kansas is too different from the rest of the country to be a good model. Kansas's biggest city, Wichita, is 400,000, and there's an aging rural population that relies on farm subsidies from the government. Brownback will have to make sure his red state model works, DeLong says.
Or it will be a horrible warning. You know, that in a decade, people will say, let's definitely not try that again. It produced a Kansas in which there were more people at work, but they were very poorly paid, and social services were actually quite lousy.
And Kansans have prided themselves on their kind of solid entrepreneurship. Bill Graves is from a prominent trucking family in Salina. He says that recognition helped him get elected to office. He served as governor from 1995 to 2003. He was very popular. In his second term, he won by the largest margin in state history. Today, he's not sure his moderate Republican philosophy would stand a chance.
I think there is a well-funded and very well-orchestrated effort right now to suggest that less government is going to be better for everyone.
And because of that, he says, moderate Republicans like Governor Graves feel they've been left without a place.
People that think a little bit more like I do have started to sort of shrink to the sidelines and just don't have the stomach or the willingness to really, you know, roll up their sleeves and fight back.
Bill Graves told us that his proudest achievements in office as governor were the results of compromise, both across party lines and within the Republican Party. Not the reality today. When newspaper writer Jason Probst talks to his friends and neighbors, they're still the people he knew when he was growing up.
But there's something that happens, or there's some kind of disconnect between that and then how they vote and how they view the political climate that brings in that anger and the angst with people.
And that's just not the Kansas, he says, he remembers. On Tuesday of this week, the trial against former Guatemalan dictator Efrain Reyes-Montt suffered what could be a major setback. General Reyes-Montt stands accused of crimes against humanity and genocide of the Maya Ixchel people during a bloody military campaign against leftist guerrillas in the 1980s. The highest court in Guatemala, the Constitutional Court, decided to change judges in the middle of the trial. Now, the new judge has voided all the testimony given by genocide witnesses over the past 2 years of the trial. Pamela Yates is a documentary filmmaker whose film When the Mountains Tremble was made during the genocide in the 1980s. Some of her footage is now being used as evidence in the case against Reyes-Montt. She's also been filming the trial since it began. Pamela Yates, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
So how significant is it that General Reyes-Montt is facing this human rights trial in Guatemala, considering how much influence he still has there?
It's enormously significant because he is the first former president to stand trial or to be indicted for genocide in his own country. So not only does it have enormous consequences for Guatemala, it's also about Latin America and the whole world.
What's your opinion of the change of the judge that we just saw?
Well, it's really a shame because the prosecution built an incredible case. They've built it over the last 13 years. They built it with eyewitness survivors and with experts, as well as using our film as part of the evidence in the case. The defense, it became clear to all of us observers in the courtroom, had never intended to mount a defense. They brought forth a few pretty weak witnesses, some which actually helped the prosecution. And then they all got together one day and they staged a mass walkout. And so effectively, that suspended the trial.
Let's go back to the very beginning, to the early 1980s. You arrive, I think it was 1982. What drew you to the Guatemalan conflict in the first place?
I had been working as a sound recordist in Nicaragua and El Salvador during the wars there when I heard about the kind of hidden war going on in Guatemala because so much of it was outside the capital in the indigenous highlands. I really wanted to go and find out what was going on. I also knew that the Guatemalan journalists trying to cover the story in their own country were being killed or disappeared. And I also knew about the United States' role in Guatemala in overthrowing the democratically elected government there in 1954 and the successive military dictatorships afterwards. So as an American citizen, I felt a certain responsibility to go and find out what was happening and try to bring the story to the rest of the world.
And remind us exactly what was happening at the time that you arrived.
Well, there was an enormous student movement, and there was an enormous movement of peasants in the countryside who wanted change in Guatemala. The military dictatorship was incredibly inflexible and not giving them any change. And instead, there were selective killings and disappearances of people that opposed the military dictatorship. And, you know, what we now know is that 200,000 people were killed during this internal conflict. 93% of the killings were done by the military and state forces, 3% by the guerrillas. Guatemala is still healing, and I think everyone is hoping that this trial will be part of the healing process.
In your first film that you made in Guatemala in 1982, at the height of the Rios Montt dictatorship, you actually get quite close to him. Let's hear something from an interview that you did with him.
¿Hay represión de parte del ejército?
No hay represión de parte del ejército.
I'm asking him if there is repression against peasants in the highlands. And he says he's the president of the country, head of the armed forces, and if he doesn't control the army, then what is he doing there? You know, genocide is a very hard claim to prove in court. You have to show that the orders came from the top, went down to those soldiers carrying them out on the ground, and then those soldiers reported back up to the top. And what he is saying is that he actually gave the orders. What his defense is trying to say is that he didn't give the orders and that these were rogue soldiers carrying out their own desires.
Take us back to that day when you went to interview General Rios Montt. What was the experience of interviewing him like?
Well, first of all, I thought he was never going to tell me the truth. I also thought he was really arrogant. You know, he treated me like a gringuita, a little gringa. And one of the things that strikes me, Jackie, watching him now at trial, is they're doing the same thing now as they did then, which is deny, deny, deny.
That's interesting because I was wondering if you had a sense of when you were interviewing him, lo, those many years ago, that someday this might be evidence against him.
Never. Because, you know, when someone's at the height of their power, you never think that they're going to lose that power. And he didn't either. And that's why he said those things.
How did you gain his confidence?
I think that the Guatemalan generals and the armed forces saw me as a possible megaphone to help convince Americans and to help convince Congress that military aid should be resumed so they could widen their counterinsurgency campaign, their scorched earth campaign. And I tried to get as much access as I could because of it.
Have you been in touch with any of the victims since this trial began and learned whether or not they're feeling like they might finally get a chance at some kind of justice?
I actually had the pleasure of staying in the hotel with the Ishil witnesses and survivors of the massacres. And they are very excited that they can tell their story. So no matter what happens with this trial, having come this far is something that would have been hard to imagine 30 years ago.
Pamela Yates, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jackie.
As the inventor of the telephone, he's credited with bringing countless voices to us. And now, for the very first time, here he is, imploring us to hear his own voice.
You are my son, Alexander Graham Bell.
Did you get that? He just said, "Hear my voice, Alexander Graham Bell."
You are my son, Alexander Graham Bell.
You'll have to forgive the poor quality. It's amazing we have it at all. The recording is nearly 130 years old. Bell made it in 1885.
It lets us know what the past was really like. It fills in a gap for people.
That's Sherry Stout, collections manager at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Stout's part of a team that restored Bell's voice. One thing it reveals, though he hailed from Scotland, Bell spent enough time in the U.S. that he doesn't have much of an accent. And Bell came from a family of elocutionists, so you can tell he's speaking carefully and clearly. Here he is, asserting his identity again. He's saying, This record has been made by Alexander Graham Bell.
This record has been made by Alexander Graham Bell.
The Smithsonian has hundreds of experimental discs and cylinders made by Bell and his partners at the Volta Lab right here in Washington, D.C. Bell left them in the Smithsonian's care, evidently to protect himself against a patent dispute.
They're all different materials. Sometimes they use plaster, sometimes tin foil, things that look like cardboard. It's very bizarre. If we could show people a picture, they wouldn't believe what they were trying to do to get sound.
But those discs have been collecting dust for more than a century. They were way too fragile for experts to try to extract the sound until now.
This is new technology that's been developed by our partners at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. It's a non-invasive technology using lasers. They started out recovering commercial records, and it turns out our curator read about it in the New York Times. They had a big break when they recovered Eau Claire de la Lune.
That recording from 1860 is the earliest that we know of. And rather than record a French folk tune, Bell was a bit more mundane. Here he is counting in dollar denominations.
Half a dollar. Half a dollar. $3 and a half.
So with all the sterling words that Alexander Graham Bell could have left for posterity, why record himself counting money?
We don't really know. One of the speculations is that they may have been inventing this technology with a hope toward using it as a business machine. And indeed, Sumner Tainer, who was one of the partners, did go on to use what came out of this technology for dictaphones, and those were used in offices.
And there are likely some more long silent treasures we can look forward to eventually hearing.
We have a few Berliner pieces, and we have some Edison tinfoils, but the bulk of our collection is from the Bell collection. So we have plenty of things hiding in our cupboards.
Alexander Graham Bell, hear my voice. A big thank you. We're ringing off now. Since the 1980s, the United States has spent millions of dollars on anti-drug ads. You've heard them.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
But research shows that some of these public service announcements might be counterproductive. Shaughnessy Farrell wrote about these TV spots in Popular Science. She says the ads may have encouraged teens to think more about illegal drugs.
Subconsciously, kids would start to think, well, I don't really know what doing drugs is like. Maybe I should try it.
Ohio University researcher Carson Wagner says there's a scientific reason for that curiosity. He calls it an information gap.
And we become curious to close that gap in information. And in this case, that gap in information is the experience of using drugs.
And it wasn't just that kids grew more curious. The clips from the early 1990s were pretty easy to mock. Carson Wagner says the ad agencies used focus groups to learn the latest slang and then tried to convince viewers that the drug dealers were dorks. Unfortunately, the lingo didn't always hit the mark.
You have people laughing at the person who's doing drugs and calling that person these names that are like so 2 years ago.
Hey, Joey, I got some stuff you just gotta try.
What is it?
Pot.
You know, marijuana.
Oh, well, I don't know.
What, chicken?
I'm not chicken. You're a turkey.
So as they approached a new millennium, the makers of PSAs adjusted. Gone were the scare tactics and the ads that made kids wonder if drugs would really scramble their brains. Instead, ads stopped mentioning drugs at all. The My Anti-Drug campaign looked at how teens who didn't take drugs spent their time.
You think about it as a bucket. If you have a bucket that's empty and you start to fill it with something, if it's filled with basketball or skateboarding or school, once it gets filled up to the top, you can't fill it anymore.
Here's one of those ads from 2001. It features a young Justin Timberlake with his former group, NSYNC.
I'm into basketball.
My family.
You know the game with the little plastic
hand puppets?
Music. Okay, guys, these are our anti-drugs. What's your anti-drug?
Only one problem. The My Anti-Drug ads were mocked even more vehemently than the older ads had been. A 2006 study showed the campaign to be largely ineffective. So, back to the drawing board. With the Above the Influence campaign, the spots began to appeal to the idea that teens want to be seen as individuals, different from their parents and even their peers. Shaughnessy Farrow says these ads are finally getting some traction.
Because so much of being a teenager is wanting to be independent, that's really the stance anti-drug ads should take, is that doing drugs is sort of going to make you part of the crowd.
In high school, all you would hear about is how high someone is or how drunk people are.
You're trying to stay strong, but it's hard.
It became a lot easier for me just to give in, and so I did.
I lost a lot of friends, and I didn't like who I was becoming.
I realized I'd be okay if I didn't do all that stuff, and people seriously respect you for that.
A study from Ohio State University found that fewer teenagers who saw the Above the Influence clips tried marijuana.
8% of teenagers in a 2011 study who had seen the campaign started smoking pot versus 12% of the teenagers that had never seen it.
But Carson Wagner says we shouldn't take that information at face value. He says ultimately, teenagers understand this information is coming from the government.
Kids are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, because they'll begin to ask the question, well, from where is the influence coming?
And hopefully they're also smart enough to know that taking drugs just isn't a good idea. Remember this scene from Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers? Treebeard, Pippin, and Merry come upon the wasted forests of Isengard. Treebeard, a giant tree himself, laments,
"Many of these trees were my friends, creatures I had known from nut and acorn."
"I'm sorry, Treebeard."
"They had voices of their own."
Voices of their own. Tolkien might have been onto something. Scientists around the world have learned that trees do indeed make sounds. And now a team of physicists in France have determined specifically what sounds trees make when they're thirsty for water. As it turns out, there are a lot of thirsty trees out there. 2 out of 3 trees are dangerously parched the world over. At least, that's what a study published in Nature determined late last year. Biologists looked at hundreds of tree species in 80 locations around the world and found,
if you increase a little bit the stress, potentially a lot of trees may die from these drought events.
That's Dr. Alexander Ponomarenko. Now, you can't use the human eye to detect a tree in desperate need of water. Well, water trees look virtually the same as their thirsty brethren. So Ponomarenko led a team of physicists at the University of Grenoble in France to detect tree stress through sound.
But they didn't know exactly where the sound is coming from. So this is where we start to work.
They designed a sensitive microphone to attach to the tree to monitor the sounds. And this is what they heard. Are you ready? Hear that? It was quick, I know. So let's take it again.
We saw in our studies that every time there is a sound, there were a bubble appearing inside the tree.
And when those little bubbles appear, the tree is thirsty.
When a bubble appears, it can trigger other bubbles around, and it's very, very bad for the tree.
Don't try this at home, though. These sounds are slowed down 1,000 times so that they can be heard by the human ear. Not all hope is lost. Dr. Ponomarenko says that as his team compiles data, they can pinpoint exactly when trees want water. The thirstier they are, the louder they become. He says one day scientists or park rangers or anyone can carry these light, specialized microphones out into the field and know just when our forests are on the brink of disaster. Then we have to learn how to save them. Let's turn to Iran. Political cartoons play an important role in Iranian newspapers. Traditionally, they're one of the few expressions of opposition to the authoritarian regime. Increasingly, cartoonists have been imprisoned, received death threats, or gone into exile because of their work. Omid Mamarian was a journalist blogger in Iran. Arrested in 2004, he was taken to prison and tortured and forced into a confession of guilt on national television. He fled the country to continue to work as a journalist here in the U.S. Now he's edited a book. It's called Sketches of Iran, and it's published by the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. It consists of 40 essays paired with political cartoons from artists inside and outside of the country. Omid begins by telling us the role of political caricatures in Iran.
It's a tradition in the Iranian media that each magazine, each newspaper has a political cartoon, a bunch of political cartoons every single day. And that's one of the first things people see when they buy a copy of a newspaper. Newspapers basically fight to have the best cartoonists for their newspapers.
So you yourself are a print journalist. Mm-hmm. Is there something you think that a political cartoon can do in terms of political impact that writing alone has a more difficult time establishing?
I can write something and my audience is limited, but people from the different ages and different socioeconomic classes can understand the meaning of a cartoon much more deeper and intimate than a story.
How difficult a time is a political cartoonist likely to have in Iran?
Many cartoonists in Iran have been arrested for the cartoons that they're drawn for newspapers. And the reason is that the Iranian government knows the power and influence of political cartoons. And for that, many political cartoonists have tried to become more ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And communicate a message in a way that makes it hard for the government to go after them.
How did the book itself come to be?
After the election, we saw an intense crackdown against journalists, civil society activists, lawyers. But I noticed that cartoons are very effective in communicating with people. And it would be a really good idea to gather a bunch of cartoons and couple them with commentaries about the themes of those cartoons.
Omid, let's start with the cover of this book. We see a giant face covering half the book, and the lips have bitten off the head of a casual person who's reading the newspaper. What's going on here?
This monstrous face is basically the environment that we live in now in Iran. The environment that journalists and bloggers and everybody who creates any kinds of content, even the people who are interested in reading newspapers, live in an environment of fear and intimidation and constant threats.
And what about Tuka Neyastani, the cartoonist? What can you tell us about him?
Tuka, he started drawing cartoons like 15 years ago. In the cartoonist community in Iran, he's one of the major pillars.
So he's living in Canada.
He lives in Canada now. He had to flee the country because he could not do what he loved to do. He was constantly under threats, and a few times he was questioned by the authorities, and once he was detained, the best thing was to leave the country and continue his work as a cartoonist for other publications out of the country. And now we see, for example, these cartoonists, thanks to the internet, they can continue their work. They draw cartoons for different publications out of the country, and millions of people inside the country can still use their work.
Let's look at another image. This one is an essay called Nima's Wish. It's paired with an image of a female lawyer. Her wrists are in manacles. She's holding the scale of justice in her hand. And what is her name?
Her name is Nasreen Sotoudeh.
And I understand that she was your own lawyer in your own case.
She was my lawyer. Initially, I was sentenced 2.5 years in prison. But because of her defense, I was acquitted from all the charges. It's very unfortunate that she is in prison now. She received a sentence for 6.5 years just for defending her client.
Hmm. When did that happen?
2 years ago.
There's another cartoon in here, and this is a portrait of Mir Hussein Mousavi. He was prime minister of Iran in the 1980s, presidential candidate in 2009. And we see him sitting beneath a picture of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and he is chained to the ballot box, which is itself chained, and it says 2009 election on it.
Mir Hussein Mousavi, the presidential candidate, since the election, he has been under house arrest for questioning the Iranian government for the result of the election, almost 3 years now.
So you have an essay here by his daughter, Zara, called The Collage That Is My Father. Tell us about this essay.
It was very difficult to find Mousavi's daughter in Iran. We know that she is under a lot of pressure not to talk to the media. We knew that she does not write for any publications. But we tried, and it paid off.
It's very, very poignant. And she talks about her father's patience. She says, he is so patient, it would frustrate us. He would tell us that he even forgets his deepest hurts within the first half hour. And for us to practice forgetting too, he always volunteered to ask for forgiveness, and he counseled patience. We must pass and endure patience, patience, patience. Is that hard for you to hear? Patience, patience, patience.
It's been very emotional. Even though I try to distance myself from my work, this is not just news. These are real people.
That was Omid Mamarian, who edited the book Sketches of Iran. That last cartoon of the candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi is the work of Nikahang Kassar. He fled Iran in 2000 after being in prison for his work and receiving a death threat. He drew six of the cartoons for the collection, so we invited him into the studio to tell us about the life of someone who does political caricature for a living in Iran.
A cartoonist in the city of Iraq, in central Iran, drew a member of parliament with a soccer jersey, and the court sentenced him to 25 lashes for that simple cartoon. Anybody who dares drawing whatever he wants to draw is attempting suicide. It's real dangerous. The problem is that if you want to draw an Ayatollah, you can't. If you want to draw a member of the military who's actually, in a way, running the country, you cannot. If you want to make fun of the president, you have to face a lot of problems.
In the book, we have a collection of 40 political cartoons. In a way, it takes us inside Iran in a way that I think even news footage cannot do. We wonder who these people are and what their circumstances are. You leave the imagination linger and wander there, I think.
I hadn't thought about this part of it, but I hope that we'll have more collections that would talk about what actually happened to the country and where we started and where we are now and possibly where we could be in the future.
That's cartoonist Nikahang Kassar. He worked alongside Omid Mamarian to compile all of the cartoons for this collection. This song is called The Night Slips Us Smiling Underneath Its Dress, and it's the first track off of Carl Hyde's debut solo album, Edgeland. Hyde is one half of the English electronic dance duo Underworld. He's also an installation artist, a painter, and a composer, frequently scoring director Danny Boyle's films. Last year, he collaborated with Boyle on the music for the spectacular 2012 Summer Olympics opening ceremony. And although he's been making dance music with Underworld for over 25 years, mixing his club beats with fragmented lyrics, Hyde wanted his first solo record to go deeper.
The idea was to become more personal, was to put myself in there. I've always hidden behind this vast wall of words. And so there was a period of, real painful period of trying to find myself.
Well, we quite like vast walls of words here at NPR. But let's talk about a song I particularly loved here. And that's Your Perfume Was the Best Thing. I'm quite an admirer of perfume myself. Your voice is so much at the center of this. Can you tell me a little of the backstory of this song?
Yeah, it was a journey that I'd made into London specifically to actually see Brian Eno give a lecture in a college in London. Had a fantastic day, gone around talking to the students and just talking about work and art and music and stuff, and just left there just on a high. Beautiful sunny day, I'm walking down the road, the lights change and it says I can cross, and there's a bus, and I cross, and as I cross, a van comes pounding down the outside of this bus and doesn't see the lights, slams on his brakes, and I just think, well, that's that then. And I just let go. And I don't know what happened. It didn't hit me. And this is the story of I'm there outside the Royal Park and the trees are just radiant in the sunshine, and this whole image of these dancing trees and this perfume, this someone's whispering to me and kind of going, not now, it's not now, you know, not your time now.
And when the impact never came, everything went quiet. All the trees stopped the dancing and I started to grin. And then you kissed me, although the drivers were watching. Help me with your lips. Up close to mine.
Cardiff Art College, where you went. You specialized in video, installations, painting. Take me back to those days, and I'm curious how you went from making art to making music.
Well, how I even got into art in the first place.
And why Cardiff?
Yeah, well, it was I followed a girl.
You're the first musician I've ever spoken to who's followed a girl.
I feel so unique. Where I come from, you either grow up and work on your dad's farm or you go and work in the carpet factory, and that was it. And so a teacher who wore a fantastic miniskirt said that she wouldn't talk to me again if I went to work in the carpet factory. And had I thought of art school? And, you know, coming from a tiny farming community, I'd never even heard of art school. So, of course, I did exactly what she said and ran away to art school. And that, coupled with my musical education, which had been John Peel on the BBC, utterly eclectic.
Yes.
You go there to listen to the blues and you end up listening to punk or electronics or whatever. That just formed my point of view of how to leave the door open constantly and to keep moving in and out of different genres and different areas.
I'm speaking with musician Carl Hyde. He's one half of the electronic music duo Underworld, and his new solo album debut is called Edgeland. You met your band member Rick Smith while you were at Cardiff College, and you guys formed Underworld together in '87, and you've had such a wonderful influence there. Did the two of you have a vision for how you were going to proceed, or were you always sort of experimenting as you went along?
We formed our first band in about 1979, 80, and that was really based on the concept of bringing black Jamaican dub together with white German electronics. We loved those two forms of music, and we both loved film music, so the soundscapes of film music. Those three areas we wanted to fuse together, and we were pretty poor, so we took the dollar and we decided we'd sign up and be pop stars, which we failed at miserably for 10 years until Rick finally threw the towel in and said, I think dance music is our calling, which is electronic music, which is what we love. And Underworld Mark II came about. So really that was the first time that we'd had a clear concept, was when Rick said, I think our home is on the dance floor. No one is ever going to listen to us. No one's ever going to play us on the radio or on TV or write about us. Our best way to go is by working with DJs. And in fact, that's what the kind of music we've been playing for 10 years, except we've been in denial.
Trainspotting was a big breakthrough for you guys. The Born Slippy B-side off the second album called Second Toughest in the Infants, and of course featured in the Danny Boyle film. You know, that film was so iconic, and it really seemed a way to introduce you to new audiences.
Yeah, it was quite a turning point for us, really. Very strange, because in a couple of ways it worked against what we believed in. First of all our friends had read Irvin Welsh's book and had come back eulogising about how great the stories were about people getting off their faces. And we thought, well, that's not really the kind of area that we want our music associated with. Mm-hmm. Strange as that might sound, mm-hmm. we never saw our music as having any drug association at all. It was about getting high off of music. Mm-hmm. So when Danny approached us, our initial reaction was no. But he convinced us. By showing us excerpts from the film in which it was clear it wasn't propagandizing anything positive about drug use at all. Then it came down to the record label Junior Boys Own to cajole us into re-releasing Born Slippy, which had already been a successful dance floor hit as far as we were concerned. And at that point, we were dead against any kind of re-release of anything. We just saw it as being really cheesy and quite crass. So they canvassed 100 DJs up and down Britain. And 99 of them, God bless him, the one in Cardiff said he hated it, but 99 of them, kind of said, you've got to re-release this, and that's what got us to do it.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. I bet you celebrated that.
Yeah, it was one of those mistakes I'm really glad we didn't make.
know, you talk about all these ideas that are eating away at you, and I'm sure continue to. You're now in your 50s, still just making all kinds of projects happen. You've done this solo album. What do you think will be next?
Oh, there's so much to do. There's hours and hours of material recorded with Brian that's yet to come out. I've got an installation that I shot at the end of last summer. I've got a lot of paintings that are on the go at the moment. So, and then music. I've started to discuss making more music. There's so many great musicians to work with, so many things to explore. You know, there's really not enough time, is there?
No, there's really not enough time. Well, Carl Hyde, I think you are the consummate abstract expressionist in whatever medium you're choosing, and I really want to thank you for all the glorious detail.
Thank you, Jackie. I really appreciate your time.
Carl Hyde, co-creator of the English electronic group Underworld, his debut solo album, Edgeland, will be released May the 7th. For the week ending April the 28th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Becky Sullivan, Acacia Squires, and Becky Hersher. We say goodbye and good luck to our intern, Annie Russell, this week. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.